Welcome to episode 92 of the Real Feedback Podcast. This episode is sponsored by Shelby Flooring Limited, domestic and commercial flooring experts. For all your flooring needs in Hertfordshire and the surrounding areas, Shelby Flooring Limited specialise in everything from laminate vinyl tiles to carpet and engineered timber flooring to name but a few. Go to shelbyflooring.co.uk, that's S-H-E-L-B-Y flooring.co.uk, or call 07706 479 860. Before I get into this week's episode officially, I'm going to be a cheeky little scamp and do a little bit of self-promotion. Because, dear listener, the band I'm in, King Cujo, the band I've banged on about relentlessly in one way or another since episode one, are releasing our first album in 18 years on this very day the podcast comes out. It's called Lost Inside the Landfill, and here is a little bit of a song from it. If you like the sound of that, go to kingcujo.com, K-I-N-G-C-U-J-O.com, for links to listen and buy. And now for the big guns. This week's guest is Johnny Took, guitarist, songwriter, all-round gentleman from DMAs. Fresh from supporting Arctic Monkeys in his home city of Sydney, we had a great chat about his recent wedding, how the songwriting and recording process has evolved from debut Hill's End to their soon-to-be-released new album, How Many Dreams. Side note, it's an absolute banger. And lots more. Please follow me on Twitter at RealFeedbackPod and go to realfeedback.co.uk for details on my live London shows, one with Diane Morgan from Afterlife and Motherland, who will be joined by comedy legend Alexi Sale at the Comedy Store in London on February 28th, and the Earth Sign acting titan Brian Blessed on March 7th at the Prince Charles Cinema. You can pre-order How Many Dreams now, and I recommend you do because it's tune after tune after tune. You get the idea. You can also hear one of those tunes at the end of this episode. This isn't an interview, this is a conversation. This is Real Feedback.
Yeah, Tommy's not well at the moment. He's just had a baby. So I think he maybe caught something from like his baby that went to daycare or something like that. Apparently that's a thing that happens sometimes.
Oh, very much so, yeah. As soon as I go to nursery, yeah, you're in for it for about a year.
It's just, yeah, they start bringing weird shit back home, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I should say congratulations to you as a newlywed. You just got married, didn't you, a couple of weeks ago?
Yes. Yeah. Couldn't be more happy, man. It was an awesome day. Had Tommy and Mason as a couple of my groomsmen, which was great. And, it was just a cracking party, to be honest.
Did you get to go away? Is there a honeymoon planned? Or was it straight back to work?
To be honest, man, like, my wife's a musician as well. We travel a lot for work. So we kind of just wanted to hang out in our apartment. We said at one point we're going to go to Japan, but we're not in a rush. We're just like, one day we're like, we're going to go do 2 weeks in Japan and we'll call that our honeymoon. But to be honest, We were just happy to, you know, I've got a couple of months off, but I've only got like one gig in the next couple of months. But then the album comes out and it's just going to be hell for leather. So
it's full on, isn't it? Yeah. I had a look at your schedule. Yeah. It's pretty big. That's good though. That's good. I mean, so how do you feel the album? I read that it was whittled down from 70 songs. Is that for 70 demos into the album? It is.
Yeah, 70 demos. You know, some demos will be only one melody. Another one might be like a whole song or something like that. So they're all different.
I've got a band as well. And we had, I don't know, 30, 40 songs. But like you say, it's not always a full song. It might be a riff or it might be a melody line that you then might then take and put in another song when that's missing something.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily 70 songs that you go, right, okay, how do we...
Exactly.
There was never a double album on the table then for the DMAs. Let's do the triple album now on the fourth one. Let's go for it.
No. Well, you could do that. People do that these days. I think Wilco just released an album that has like fucking 22 songs on it or something. God. Like that. And lots of people do it now because because it's good for streaming.
Of course, yeah, yeah. I guess this will change now because you quite regimentally. I think you're all you're 12 songs an album, pretty much, or thereabouts, which is kind of like, yeah. Is there like a big discussion, interband discussion, as to, I mean, track listing, for example, is another big one for me. That when I recorded in September, and it's like, well, how the song's going to flow, because all your favourite albums, you can't imagine them being in a different order. So for this album, for example, was there sort of a concept flow to, because the way it ends, my God, we're going to get onto the last track, which is just, I can't wait to see that song live. That's going to just absolutely.
Oh, Takale.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I can't wait.
That's totally going to, have you played it live yet?
No, we haven't done that yet, but
yeah, that's going to just we're
definitely
going
to incorporate it. I can't wait to see that.
How was supporting Arctic Monkeys? I mean, in your hometown as well. So is it like a? Come on, guys, we'll show you the clubs, we'll show you the bars. we know the area.
It was cool, dude. It was cool. It was obviously really special to, you know, to play a gig of that size, and especially at the Domain in our hometown, and that was really great. And I think we played well, but it was a great experience. But it was 3 days after my wedding, so like, as awesome as it was, it kind of felt insignificant compared to getting married. You know, compared to the emotion. Of that day. Not sorry, I didn't want that to sound you know, whatever, but it was like I was still burning off the high of getting married, and it was like 3 days later. But so I just had a great time, and we played a lot of big gigs, you know. So I don't like to think of any gig as different to another. You can kind of psych yourself out from that, you know what I mean? If you know the songs, you know how to play them well, just get up and fucking have fun and do your job, you know.
I think for me, when I play, the biggest worry on my mind is this is something going wrong sound wise, or, you know, strings breaking or the amp exploding or whatever. You know, it's not like you say, if you're especially you guys, it's your job. You know, you've played many more gigs than I have, and it's just down to the technical stuff fucking up, isn't it? It's like, you know, getting electrocuted or whatever, or someone.
Yeah. No, the cool thing is that we pay people to look after that, so. That's one worry off our minds, you know, because when you're playing gigs of that capacity or caliber, you know, you don't want to have to be worrying about, you know, if that shit goes wrong. And our crew are amazing, and we're a pretty well-oiled machine, and, you know, touch wood, but we haven't had too many problems. So, and, you know, we're about to have a problem at one point, and I kind of just love off when that stuff happens, you know what I mean? Because it's like, well, it's live music, you know. It's
that was different.
It's real. these things happen. Yeah. There was something. When was I playing recently? And I did that's right. Yeah, we were playing a song. It was after COVID, and it'd been a couple of years. And we're playing a song of ours called "Criminals," and there's a part that is done on the sampler, and I was kind of new to it, and I was also playing piano, and, you know, I could play pads and keys, but I didn't play just like me playing piano, you know, in front of 20,000 people very often. I have to play to a click track in that song. So it's kind of like, you know, for when all the band comes in and everything starts rocking. So basically it's just like me playing to this like click track on the piano. I was really nervous. And I was like, oh my God, I've made it through. Yeah. The first time I played it. I'm fine with it now. And then I went to hit the sampler, but I forgot to change the setting of the sampler from Life is a Game of Changing into Criminals. And so I hit the sampler, and the sample of the riff of Life is a Game of Changing started coming out, which is, I think, a semitone flat from like, semitone sharp from the key that Criminals is in.
Yeah.
So it really couldn't be much worse. And basically after that happened, I was like, well, like, it can't be more fucked than that. You know what I mean? Yeah. So then all my nerves were gone.
There's only 20,000 people watching me. It's fine.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, well, that stunk. And I think everyone was like, what the fuck? They were pretty drunk at that point, but it's live music. This shit happens. And it's a part of the game, and it's also why people love it. And I can take that on the chin. I can have a laugh at myself.
And they're probably thinking, I love how Johnny's merging the songs together in this kind of avant-garde mix. Yeah, it's totally purposeful, yeah, guys. Yeah, it's totally purposeful. So how does the support thing work? Do you get picked by the bands? Do you pitch to the artists that you want to play with? Can we come and tour with you? Or is it a label thing? Because you've obviously toured with Liam Gallagher as well and Richard Ashcroft.
Well, to be honest, the Arctic Monkeys support was the only support we've ever done in Australia. We've never supported a band in Australia, which is kind of weird. It's different every single time. Sometimes it's like the label. Sometimes the band is, you know, purposely ask for you because then it's, you know, because they've maybe heard a track and they think it's good. And like the first time we came over to the UK was because the Cortinas lead singer Liam was like, he'd heard Delete, his mate played him at a party, he played him Delete, and he was like, holy shit. And then they emailed our management and pulled us over to the UK. One of their support tours, and that was the first time we'd ever come over to the UK. Yeah, so it can happen in heaps of different weird ways. Sometimes it's a favor to a friend or a label or a manager, and other times it's just the cool band that you heard. Mm. You know,
what a compliment though. From if he had just heard the one song, was like, They're on the tour, get them over. I bet when he said, where are they from? Are they from Coventry? Or, you know, no, they're from the other side of planet. Fuck. That's going to be expensive to bring them over.
Yeah. Oh, no, expensive for him. It's expensive.
Well, yeah.
But it was worth it, you know, because it's like, if you're going to spend the money to get over there, at least you want to fucking get in front of some heads.
So when, what I like to do when there's a band that's got quite a few albums out is kind of compare with them the sort of the first album and the new album in terms of writing it and the process and the actual and recording it, because obviously first album generally is written when a band isn't signed, so it's, you know, them, you're with your mates and you're in a studio around the corner writing your tunes. But then four albums in, you've been playing Reading and Leeds and touring and stuff, and it's just a completely different ball game. So what are the main kind of differences for you sitting down writing songs for this album than writing Hill's End, for example?
So the main difference is that we all had jobs when we were writing Hill's End, you know, so like, you know, that's kind of different. Like now it's like my job is to write songs, so I wake up every day and I write, pretty much work on some kind of idea or some kind of song. So that's cool. But I was actually kind of doing that anyway, even when I was working, to be honest. I'd still try and write one shitty song a day.
What was your job before?
I worked a bunch of random jobs. I worked in a factory for Subi, like sorting out clothes, like just in the warehouse. I've worked in a bottle shop for a long time, like a drive through bottle shop. And then me and my brother, Matty Took, we played in cover bands, not in cover bands, but we played as a duo. We used to play like Bob Dylan and bluegrass traditionals and stuff like that, around pubs like three or four times a week. And that's how I kind of learned a lot about songwriting and, you know, play like The Band and Creedence Clearwater and stuff like that, and like learned a lot about songwriting in that regard through just playing hours and hours of cover gigs and pubs.
Well, interesting you mentioned The Band. I just got the Last Waltz on Blu-ray for Christmas. Ooh. I've seen it before, but I haven't seen it for years. It's so good. It's so good. And
it's
one of
the best.
I was watching it because I remember reading that they had to digitally remove the cocaine out of Neil Young's nostril because when he comes
That's
on,
right.
he had a massive rock of coke shoved up his nose. And apparently, yeah, they digitally erased it. It's amazing what they can do
That's
these days.
That's pretty
cool. Yeah. You can imagine going, leave it there, man.
Yeah.
It's how it was. So the album's at the end of March, is that right? Is it the 31st of March?
Yeah, March 31st.
Yeah, so we've already heard sort of four tracks of it because you've had four singles out. But it's I've had it on heavy rotation since the PR company sent it to me, and I fucking love it. And I'm not just saying it to blow smoke up your ass, but it is a really good album because, and I've had this with a few musicians I've had on recently where there's a lot of different styles on the album, and that could so easily not work. Sometimes it doesn't with certain bands, but it totally works here because you've got, like I say, the song which you've already said, and I can't remember how you pronounced it because I knew I was going to get that wrong.
Oh, Decale.
Yeah, I thought, is it Decal? And there's another one on there as well. I'm going to, JLA.
Oh, Highlight.
Fuck, totally wrong. Okay, Decale. Let's go with Decale then, which is like this full-on dance floor banger, but not in a, when I say dance floor, I mean like, I don't want to say ravey because that makes me sound my age, but it's, for me, it was a very different sort of track.
Yes.
Especially if you're comparing it to the first album, obviously, but even from other songs on the album, it's like, it just ends on this, and I can just see 20,000 people in a field just losing their shit to this song. So was there always the case of like, the last track on this album is going to be, yeah, is it always going to be that song?
Yeah, basically, yeah. I've had that song. So when I first started getting into like mucking around with electronic music and whatnot, that was like one of the earliest songs I kind of wrote. And then I was living in Melbourne and I brought Tommy down for a weekend, and we basically just got pretty pissed, to be honest, and we just went to town on it, and we just had fun, and we hung out in my apartment, and we just layered all these vocals on it, and yeah, Tommy wrote pretty much all the melodies on this song, and just used the instrumental track that I'd written as inspiration, and yeah, I love it because it was the track that I would always play to people. If I was ever at a party or a after party or something with some other musician mates, and
listen to this, get it on.
Yeah. So we're always like listening to demos and stuff, and I would like put that one on. I was always the most proud of it because it was different for DMAs, and it's got a particular energy to it, and it's probably one of my favorite songs.
Well, how do you write a song like that? Because using Hill's End again as a comparison, you probably sat there with an acoustic guitar, I imagine, for the most part, to initially write the song, and then all the other layers come in either before you go in the studio or while you're recording. But a song like this, which isn't an obvious, you know, guitar, bass, drums, vocal style song, how do you... You say you're mucking around with electronic stuff. Do you just play with samples, and then when you get a sound, you get a melody come into your head, and then you work on that? So how does it work for this style of song?
It's completely different. So it's like basically like mucking around with synthesizers, mucking around with sequences. So one thing I'll do is like I'll have a sequence that is doing like triplets, and then I'll have a sequence that's doing eighths, and then I'll have a sequence that's doing sixteenths, and then I'll have them all running at the same time in key and moving around each other and changing notes here and there and playing off harmonics and stuff like that. And then I'll put a beat behind it, normally a dance beat. And then when you ground it with the dance beat, all the other polyrhythms that are playing at the same time evoke different feelings. And then I'll write physical riffs over those parts. And basically, when all the parts are working together, what I'll do is I'll mute certain parts and see which combination of all these parts work best together.
Mm. And when you're writing, do you think, this is what I've always been curious about with successful bands, is that when you've done X amount of tours and you know what songs are working with the crowd and what parts of the songs are working with the crowd, does that influence how you write and you think, oh, this, if we put in a, I mean, I'm really simplifying here, but, you know, a whoa chorus, they're likely to sing that back to us. Does that enter your mind, or do you just think, I'm writing this song for myself, if they're on board, great, if not, that's tough shit? Do you know what I mean? I don't know if that made any sense at all. If you're writing with the live audience in mind.
It makes sense. No, I've started doing that recently. I never used to do it, but I've started doing it recently just because live music has become such a big part of what we do. And us playing festivals and all that kind of stuff, it's hard to ignore it. The opening track, How Many Dreams, I wrote that as an opening track for the album. We all wrote parts of the songs, but when I originally wrote it, it was kind of like an instrumental, and it was and I wrote it as an opening track, and lots of times when I write opening tracks as well, I imagine them opening the set, because I do like opening the set with the opening track of the album, of that tour, because it gets people excited, because if they've been listening to the new record, they know that, you know, that's how it starts. Mm. And I think that's a cool way to start a record as well.
I've written on my notes next to How Many Dreams, it's a gig opener. Because
there you go.
Totally is. When I first heard it, I was like, oh, they should open with that. You know, that's amazing. How do you shape your set now then for the new tour when you know you've got all these new tunes? Because speaking from experience, whenever I've got a load of new songs, I just want to play those. But not that anyone who comes to see me really gives a shit whether we play old ones or not, because we probably have 50 people come to see us. But do you know what I mean? Your fans will expect to hear Delete and all these other tunes.
Yeah, I don't think you can flood the set with too many of the new songs straight up. I think you got to remember, if the album's only been out for a year, for like 6 days or something, or like 2 weeks, when I think when we play in London, in UK next, it wouldn't have been out for very long. So I don't think you can overwhelm them with it, with too many. I think you got to remember that people still want to hear those songs. But then at the same time, you know, fuck, when you've released 4 albums and 2 EPs, you've nearly released 60 songs. So, you know, to pick 17 out of that, it's hard.
So when you go on tour, I was just curious as to the closest I ever got to a tour was 2 gigs in Spain. That was it. That's the only time I've had someone plug in my guitar for me and take it from me as I leave the stage. Other than that, it's all been like lugging it around myself. So when you have that luxury and when you're on tour with your mates, what's the non-music stuff? Like, what do you do? Do you soak in the culture? Do you stay in a hotel room and watch movies? What's the DMA's time off schedule like? Or do you just get shit faced and go, we haven't got a gig tonight, let's just get plastered. Let's get down the pub.
I don't know. What do we do? To be honest, most of it's pretty intense. So if we got a day off, we're kind of doing washing or...
all the rock and roll stuff.
Yeah, all the rock and roll stuff. We're just taking it easy. One thing we do like to do is, like, we're really fortunate in Australia to have really great Asian food in general. And we really love Chinese food, so we always try and find like a really cracking Chinese restaurant, and we go get a group of us, and you know, we can have a few more beers than we would because we're not going to have to play a show or something like that, and you can have a big meal and stuff, because you don't you can't eat too much food before you go on stage. It kind of ruins the gig. So sometimes we try and find a really good Chinese restaurant. We love that. Recently I've been going to driving ranges and playing a bit of golf, with our guitarist Joel. Yeah, which is cool. And that's a pretty good one, because if you're on the bus, you arrive of the day off. So, the band get most of the day off till about 3 o'clock. So if you go early morning, you can get 9 holes in or whatever.
I'm so bad at golf. I've only ever done 9 holes because it takes longer than a normal person playing 18 holes. It's just the ball could go absolutely anywhere.
Yeah.
If you played golf for me, you'd murder me by the third hole, basically.
I'm not very good, but I'm good enough. I have enough good shots to warrant coming back. Let's just say that, and that's all you kind of really need with golf. You know, like I'm like, oh, you know what? Like we come back and do it. You know?
Just as people are about to get worried, you pull one out of the bag.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the food thing. One of my jobs is I'm in a covers band. Exciting, but we play at the Hard Rock Hotel in London, and one of the good things is they feed you. But the problem is they feed you just before you go on, and they do these like burgers that are normally £22 or something. But you go, if it's free, I'm going to have one, and then the whole band get up on the stage 5 minutes after eating, and you can't move because you're just eating half a cow, so it doesn't really work. But so can you play drunk? Have you have a few beers if you're not playing. Have you ever gone a little bit overboard before a gig and then got up and played and thought, fuck, I've probably pushed it a bit too far?
Yeah, sometimes I have, but I've never fucked up, which is kind of bad. Like it's like I probably like if I'd like gone drunk too much, but to be honest, we used to do that maybe in the early days. We had a few shockers because it's exciting. It's like, you know, you're 24, you're traveling the fucking world, you're selling out 200-250 tickets in Newcastle, you know, in the UK or something. You're like, you're fucking excited and you're young and you're kind of fearless and the stakes aren't that high. But to be honest, once the show started getting to a certain caliber, it kind of boils down to respect after that point, because you're like, well, you know, it's not 200 people, you know, in a pub in you know, wherever. It's, you know, it's 3,500 people in London, or it's like, you know, it's fucking 2,500 people in Manchester or something like that. And it's like people pay good money to come and see you play, you know. So you know, we kind of cut any of that ridiculous stuff out a while ago, and we got kind of got it out of our system while we were young, which you have to do, you know, you have to do. There's definitely been some shockers back in the day.
Yeah, I did one. I managed normally to play quite well. I mean, years ago my band were around the first time, I drank a whole bottle of Bacardi, of white rum, during the gig. But I still played absolutely fine. And as soon as I finished, I put my guitar down, I went outside for a smoke and just puked everywhere. It was like someone just punched me in the back and just fired out into a bush. It was like, oh, yeah, that's fair enough. But somehow managed to hold it together in the gig. But yeah, some people...
It's probably the adrenaline.
Well, yeah, but I've seen people who can't... I used to play with a guy who used to get absolutely annihilated every gig, and he'd hand the guitar to the crowd or the mic and get them to sing, and you've got the management coming out taking photos of him and then getting ready to ban you after the gig.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry, we digress. So the thing I love about another thing I love about your band is that you've got all these huge bangers like Decale, like you say, but you've also got these other songs that are just I'm going to write a heart on sleeve love song and, you know, pour it all out there. And I think that's why that's one of the big pulls with DMAs and why people love you guys so much, is because you are very emotive in your songwriting and in your lyrics, and there's quite a lot of love songs, air quotes, on this album, like lyrically, because I think you've said, was it you that was quoted as saying something like you love that you found someone who loves you unconditionally for whoever you are, or something like that. I'm completely paraphrasing and getting it wrong.
Yeah.
But you seem to just you seem to be quite happy to just to write a song about that and just put it out there. And I think people respect that and because you think a group of lads.
Yeah, that was for I Don't Need to Hide.
That's it. Yes.
Well, I kind of grew up listening to country music, which is like, you know, that shit to the extreme. So. I kind of like maybe took the lyric side of that from things. And also it's like, you know, like Stone Roses would write 10-story love song and stuff like that. And, you know, And like the Verve would write beautiful love songs as well. It's like everyone knows, maybe people don't vocalize it as much, but everyone's fucking doing it. And like, and so it's like, if that's true and we're doing it, I might as well talk about it.
Mm. Are you a big Verve fan then? I was a huge, huge Verve fan.
Yeah, I love the Verve.
But second album is my favorite, Northern Soul. Because everyone goes, Urban Hymn. Oh, Urban Hymns. No. Go back one. Because that's the sound of that's the sound of a man falling apart and just putting it all out on the road. You can hear it in his voice on that album as well. It's incredible. I had the chance to see them on that tour, and I didn't. It was at Glastonbury. This is how old I am. It was Glastonbury in the '90s, and I didn't know. I'd never heard of them, and it was years later. I looked at the lineup and saw the Verve one there, and it would have been.
Oh wow!
And it was pre Urban Hymns. I was like, fuck, and Jeff Buckley as well. And I didn't know. I didn't know who he was. I couldn't see Jeff Buckley. Yeah, I was not happy about that at all. Yeah, quite upset. So one of the, I mean, don't want to go on who your influence is because that's such a boring question. But one of the ones that I read on your biography that I was sent was Sonic Youth. Now, is that one of your influences, or is that one of the other guys? Because that was a real surprise, but a nice.
That's one of Mason's influences. So Mason kind of like, when we met Mason, he was kind of more into like, he was deep into the, what's it called? Like more like American style guitar music.
So alternative rock, that sort of thing.
Grunge. Dinosaur Jr., Pavement, Sonic Youth, you know, bands like that, where me and Tommy kind of came from more of a British sound. And I think you can kind of hear that in lots of our music and in Mason's style of guitar playing. It's even though the songs have a British flair to them, the guitar lines, a lot of the guitar lines are more reminiscent of some of those American bands.
Mm. I mean, there's loads of, I always hate saying, oh, this song sounds like this, this song sounds like this, because I think it's a really lazy way to, and also as from the musician's point of view, you don't want to be told who you sound like, because you don't want to sound like anyone but yourself. But at the same time, for people who haven't heard the album, I have to try and, you know, paint a picture, so to speak.
Of course.
But there's songs like Get Ravy. It's got that really cool, it's like a Peter Hook. I'm assuming it's the bass riff at the start. I don't know, it might be guitar, but it's like a cool bass riff on it.
The guitar, yeah.
Yeah. But I can hear all these, like you say, there's a lot of the British influences in the music, but it never once sounds like a carbon copy of any sort. I mean, you can pick any big band and go, well, you can hear that they're listening to that or they're influenced by that.
To be honest, that song was I'd never really listened to Sonic Youth, and I started listening to them, and I listened to them for a week, and then I wrote that song.
Oh my god, wow. Was it just a bit of a broad, did Mason say, right, listen to that and that, or did he say listen to
that?
Nah, because there's a lot of it. A lot of it.
Yeah, I know, like Teenage Riot, of course, is like where you start, you know. And then I can't really remember where I went from there. I just kind of, you know, I just kind of just went for it. I kind of do that a lot. I've realized I'm quite impressionable, and I've used it almost in a positive way. And I can kind of listen to a band for like a week, and then like I'll go and write a song, and I know that even if I wrote my version of their song, it won't sound anything like them. It's just because of how I am and who I am and the intricacies of me. So I found it's actually a good way to write, where if I just like inundate myself with, you know, with a band that inspires me or something, or a style of music that's different to what I usually do, and then start writing after doing that for a few days or a week or something like that. And I normally land somewhere pretty cool.
Well, Get Ravy. I didn't hear Get Ravy and think Sonic Youth, so that's a good thing. Because it's also a very uplifting tune. And Sonic Youth aren't really known for their jubilant, cheer up, guys.
Well, I didn't write the chorus thinking about Sonic Youth. I wrote the chorus separately in my studio in Melbourne. And then I Frankensteined them later. And I was really lucky because singing that I don't know why I can't go back instead in the verses is at the bottom of Tommy's register, And then when he goes, satellite, it's 1 in a million to find, and the chorus, which is up the octave, that is like at the top of his register. So it's like literally, you couldn't, even if you took the song a key down, he couldn't sing it low enough. And if you took it a key up, he couldn't sing it high enough.
And how did he feel about you?
You know what I mean? Like, so that.
You've really challenged him on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, he started to get a bit annoyed with me recently because of some of the melodies I've been writing have been a little bit ridiculous recently. But
like the Christina Aguilera vocal acrobatics, which I can't stand it. I get this. It's a thing. But anyway, well, best of luck with everything. The album is fucking great, and Wembley Arena. You're playing Wembley Arena.
Yeah, crazy. Crazy.
That's insane. But I'm coming to that because I want to hear you open.
Oh,
with,
awesome.
Well, thank I want to hear you open with How Many Dreams, and I want to hear you end on. Do you reckon Ducale is an a gig ender, or is it ending on the classic?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if we'll play it on this tour. Maybe we'll, like, it'll be one of those ones that we bring in when we come back another time around, or maybe we'll get ready. But we haven't really decided yet, so we're just still kind of working out what we're going to play. Because, you know, it's like some of the songs Mason wrote for this record, some of my favorite, like Olympia, that's going to be a staple in the live set. That guitar riff is one of my favorites, and High Lie as well. It's so beautiful, but you just can't. And I really like Something We're Overcoming as well. I think that's going to be really polarizing for some people. Which will be pretty funny, but I really like that song. It's kind of like trancey and it's a bit tongue in cheek, but kind of fun.
I think people are more open minded these days with a band veering off the beaten track. I mean, if you go back to, you can even go back to Dylan, which is when they were, you know, it's abhorrent to think him picking up an electric guitar. But then even in the '90s with Nirvana, with everyone that went to see them because of Smells Like Teen Spirit, and then they played the third album, which was just a noise, and they lost a ton of fans. But then you could even use Arctic Monkeys. You know, you got someone I know went to see them at, was it Reading last year? And they said they've got a really young crowd that don't like the early stuff. So every time they play something like Dance Floor, the young crowd are kind of like looking around. But then when they play stuff from the new album or Casino, they're right into it. It's like, what? But I think a band get max respect when they just go, look, this is where we're going now. If you don't like it, you can fuck off in the nicest possible way. So
yeah, it's sweet.
Yeah, but I think people are being into
it. Also, if they want to listen to the first record, they can listen to the first record. That's sweet. And it's just like, and it's going to change. You know, I know we'll probably go back and make a rock record soon. And also, like, there are heaps of rock songs on this new album.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's like Get Rapey is a rock song, you know. Olympia is a great rock song. Fading Like a Pictures. That one's been awesome as well. So
yeah. Good. So the tour kicks off. I think you've got a couple of gigs in a couple of weeks, haven't you? But not in the UK. And then you've got the UK tour starting in April. I think just after the album release.
Yeah, so the UK tour starts in April, and then we've got a one-off gig in Tasmania next week or something, so that should be fun. I like Tasmania.
Well, Johnny, yeah, best of luck to you and the guys. We wish Tommy better as well. That's, you know, par for the course when you've got a new kid. but all the best for the new album. Everyone pre-order it now and get your tickets for the tour. So, Johnny, thanks very much, mate. Nice to meet you. Cheers.
Awesome. Thanks, man. I appreciate that.